KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to have on Professor George Contreras of American University School of Law, author of the forthcoming article, that is to say, it is still in draft form. The article is entitled Wait For It, Latency, Copyright, and the Private Ordering of Scientific Publishing. So this focus is something that we've discussed from time to time on Hearsay Culture, which is the idea of open science or the sharing of knowledge in different industries and fields. And we focus heavily on Hearsay Culture by virtue of my interest and background and scholarly focus in intellectual property law. Here we're going to do that as well by focusing on copyright's implication on scientific publishing. And so the issue there is a very challenging one, and I think a very interesting one, but also very important from a practical perspective. The history, as George writes about in this article, of the scientific community was to, as he says, literally, currently not public draft, but a draft that will be made public next week, and I'll post the link on SSRN. George says that in the 1940s, sociologist Robert K. Merton famously identified the willingness of scientists to share their discoveries and findings as one of the fundamental norms that characterizes both the practice and culture of science. And so with that jumping off point, the question is, what is copyright law doing in that mix? Copyright, which is designed to create certain rights with authors to, among other things, right, control copying, dissemination, distribution, reproduction, and so forth of their works. How does copyright work when you have a moray in a field like scientific publishing where sharing is the norm or certainly encouraged? And so in this article, George takes a close look at scientific publication and how we can think about copyright in that context. And in the article and in our discussion, we're going to be looking at a variety of perspectives because there are some, including former guests on this show, David K. Levine and McKelly Boltron, who have written that we should get rid of copyright for academic works. Others have said we should in fact even strengthen it. Within the IP academic world, literally yesterday, there was a discussion going on among a number of professors regarding indemnification agreements by publishers that require or would ask the authors, that is professors, to indemnify the journal against any claims of defamation. So in other words, the journal takes the position that if anyone sues claiming that the article defames them or is untrue in some way, that the author would in fact cover the risk. Now, that's a contract issue, but it also implicates, again, the question of what rights are associated with copyright. So in our discussion today, we're going to have a pretty wide-ranging discussion focusing on George's article and hopefully get into some of these more tangential but related issues regarding whether, in fact, we want scientific publishing to be shared and what the implications and downsides of those might be. George, as I mentioned, is currently a visiting assistant professor at American University School of Law. However, in the fall, he will be joining the faculty full-time as an associate professor. He's joining us from his office at American University Law School. We are recording on February 9th for airing on February 10th, 2012. George, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
David, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Let's start off, George, with a question that I ask virtually all of my authors, and so I will make no exception here. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you came to the point that you wanted to write this article.
Well, sure, I'd be happy to. As you alluded to in your introduction, this work is really part of a larger project that looks at scientific knowledge more broadly and how it can be made accessible as broadly as possible and whether that's a good thing or not. And the sort of theoretical framework around that set of discussions often mentions the commons, right? This is a discussion that I know previous guests have had with you and that I have engaged in over the years. So before I entered academia, which is fairly recently, I was in the practice of law, and I did intellectual property transactional work. And, you know, in the practice, the knee-jerk reaction from most people, whether they're clients or lawyers, is that the more IP protection you have, the better. Let's maximize protection as much as possible, and that's what you strive for often when you're representing clients. But in the late 90s, I began to represent and got involved with a group that was sort of a spinoff from the Human Genome Project called the SNP Consortium, which was a very innovative project that was made up of scientists and policymakers, both from the government but also from private industry, who had this idea that it would be a good idea to put scientific information out in the public domain so that lots of people, both academics and industrial scientists, could access it and use it for free rather than having to reproduce it in their own labs. And the theory behind that was that that would create greater efficiencies. It would let them all access a common base of information. That project went very well and is often cited as a successful example of modern scientific sharing between government, academia, and industry. And that work, which I'm continuing to dabble in, has led to some very interesting projects relating to public access to data from large-scale scientific projects in genomics and other areas of research. The principal intellectual property focus in that work is patents. And there's been a lot of talk, of course, about patenting genetic material and scientific discoveries and so forth. And that's something that I've worked on in the past as well. But the topic today on scientific publishing and how copyright comes into this is a very natural outgrowth of that other work. Because, as you mentioned, scientific articles, and we can talk about them in more detail in just a second, are covered potentially by copyright. And so making this information public, you have to contend with the protections that copyright affords to those articles. And that's really how this all got started.
So let me take a top-level approach here and make sure that for those that aren't familiar that we know what we're talking about. When we say a scientific publication, is that as broad as it sounds, anything involving science, or do you have a specific focus in a type of article or field or some kind of way to narrow that definition?
Yeah, I think that it is a bit narrower. So things like a high school biology textbook, a New York Times science article, some sort of a popular science magazine that you would get at the newsstand. Those aren't really the subject that I'm talking about. I'm really talking about professional scientific publications in which scientists disclose their research results, right? They disclose original research. And the data and their findings and their conclusions from those data, as opposed to teaching or re-reporting or popularizing those types of results. And it may sound like it's a fairly small niche that we're talking about, but this is a $6 billion industry, and there are probably upwards of 20,000 scientific journals, everything from what are called the one-word titles, which are the most prestigious, generally Science, Nature, Cell, and so forth, to very specialized journals that cover research into particular diseases or phenomenon.
And so we're talking about a worldwide scientific community as well, right? You're not focusing your interest, although you're focusing on U.S. law perhaps, you're not focusing your interest on U.S. scientists, or am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. This is an international marketplace. Science is conducted in a very international basis, which creates its own interesting dilemmas, which are probably beyond the scope of what we're talking about today in terms of governmental grant funding and so forth. But yes, scientists typically work internationally and often couldn't care less about the national home of a journal that they submit their work to and that they publish in. The journals, in fact, many of the prestigious journals are not published by U.S.-based publishers. They're primarily European. The Nature Publishing Group in the U.K., Elsevier, which is a Dutch, an Anglo-Dutch corporation, Springer, which is German. So, yes, it's a very international market.
And so walk me through, again, top level, before we get into the problem that you address here. Walk me through the process of a scientist authoring or co-authoring an article and getting it published. I mean, from the perspective of copyright, for example, how does that work?
For a long time, the scientists will be working in the laboratory, doing experiments and gathering data. Once data presents some sort of interesting result, and there's a common term in science, you try to publish with the minimum publishable result, because publications are important to scientists in terms of their career advancement, getting endowed chairs, getting grant funding. You want as many publications as possible. So as soon as you get any sort of result that is of some significance, you will write that up into an article, right? There will be a huge mass of data typically behind any article. The articles don't present the raw data, the output from the sequencing machines or the telescopes or whatever the scientific data gathering apparatus is. They'll be English language, and I use that intentionally because most publication is in English, but they'll be written in prose in a manner that typically only other scientists can really understand deeply, but can be understood by a reading audience. The scientists will put together that article and then submit it to a journal to see if they want to publish it. And this is the same as we do in legal academia and elsewhere. If you're writing a short story, you submit it to magazines, see who wants to publish it. You generally work down a hierarchy of journals that you submit to based on their prestige, their impact rating, and there are various services and publishers out there who do publish impact ratings for journals. So you start at the top and work your way down and see who accepts your article. When a journal accepts your article, they go through a number of steps, right? First, there's an initial editorial screen. The editors to the journal typically will screen out articles, A, that are beyond the scope of their journal. If they're a journal about cardiology, they're not going to be looking at articles about geological formations that were just discovered at the bottom of the ocean, right? They do some screening for that. They screen out articles that are, written by people who are obviously crackpots and not part of the established community. And again, there's criticism of that function as well. But there's some initial screening that goes on. Once they find articles that look like they are suitable and reputable, they will send them out for what's called peer review, which is a critical segment of the process, right? Peer review is a process where two, three, or four other scientists who are not connected with the research in the article but who are in the same field will read the article. Sometimes it's on an anonymous basis, sometimes not. And they will give the journal their feedback and say, well, this seems like a good article, we should publish it. Or this seems like a good article, but, it's got a couple of places that I think need to be fleshed out more, or even more disappointing for the author, it's a good article, we should publish it if the author did this additional experiment. Or they could just give it the thumbs down and say, we don't think that our journal should publish this article. So the peer reviewers are volunteers. They're not staff of the journal. They're not paid by the journal, but they're members of the scientific community in the same general field. And all scientists, all working scientists, act as peer reviewers for the journals in their field. It's part of their general professional responsibility, and they have to do it in order to make the system work.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to continue with the process, but...
Go ahead, because I think I probably was going to ask the follow-up that you were going to get to, so...
Okay, so after the peer reviewers give their feedback and the author revises the article and it's in a form that the journal is ready to publish it, then out comes the publishing agreement, at the end of the process. And here's where copyright comes in. Almost all scientific journals use a similar form of publishing agreement. And the agreement says you, author, are hereby assigning to us the copyright in this article. You assign it outright. We don't pay you, but we will publish the article and we'll give you some reprints and so forth. So there's some consideration, and it's in writing, so it meets all of the statutory formalities. Once that is done, then the journal publishes the article.
So the process involving peer review is interesting. Of course, it differs from traditional legal publishing, for example. But I think it's important also to note right who these publishers are and who the authors are. Right, you mentioned that the authors are writing these articles; they're publishing their work because they need to in the field. But I guess the question becomes: are they publishing articles because they want to get royalties or in any other way directly make money from the publication? And that varies from field to field. So I guess my question ultimately is, what are there any pecuniary, i.e. utilitarian copyright-type incentives for publishing in the scientific community?
For the scientists.
For the scientists, correct.
Right, so the scientists have a number of incentives. Some of them are pecuniary, but they do not derived directly from the revenue that comes from publishing the article. So scientists are employed by either academic institutions or companies or research institutions. Somebody pays their salary. Part of the job of being an academic scientist is to publish articles. In order to get tenure at an academic institution, you need to publish a large number of articles in prestigious journals. So there's a career advancement function that these articles play. And that's probably what's viewed as the most important one. There's also grant funding. So government agencies who support scientific research, like the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation in the U.S., other organizations outside of the U.S., obviously, when deciding who to grant money to conduct research, you know, they have to look very carefully. Recent statistics, I think, came out that NIH, which has a $30 plus billion research budget to fund external research, can only fund about 18% of the grant requests that are made this year. They have to be very selective, and one of the criteria that they use in selecting grant recipients are the publication record of the grant recipient. How much publication have they done off of other grants that have been granted by that agency? Because the governmental agency's goal is to produce science that is broadly accessible in a large degree. So money does flow to the academics, but not through the publishing enterprise itself.
Now let's get into, and we're chatting with Professor George Contreras of American University School of Law on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. With regard to the title of your article, I understand copyright. We're going to get into private ordering, but what is this word latency? What does that have to do with the problem that we're going to discuss now?
Right, so with the word latency, I'm betraying a little bit of my educational background, which is in electrical engineering. And latency is a term that engineers use a lot to describe delays in circuit components caused by various factors. So latency is a delay in something. And in some of the previous work that I've done, I've looked at these timing delays between when something is created and when it enters what we've been calling the commons. So with scientific data and that work, you know, there's a period of time between when a scientist collects a large set of data and when that scientist releases it to the public. And I call that the latency of the data. With these journal articles, there's a latency as well. There's a latency period between the time that the author writes the article and when it ultimately ends up published, and from the time it ends up published until it can be broadly accessed. And one of the main issues that the article wrestles with is the limited access to these articles once they're published.
And that gets us immediately to the other side of the coin. I asked you about the author's interest here, but what are the publisher's interests? And which I think implicates directly the copyright issue about which you're concerned.
Right. It absolutely does. So if you look at scientific publishing since it began back in the 17th century, roughly, from the 17th century through, say, the end of World War II, most scientific publishing was done by learned societies, right? So the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Academy of Sciences in Britain, or you know, the Journal of the American Medical Association, societies, professional associations run by scientists that provided their members with a number of benefits, benefits including meetings and networking opportunities and a voice in the broader social discourse, and then the magazine that you get every month from the association, right? All of us who are lawyers, we get a journal every month if we're part of the American Bar Association from them. So journal publishing was obviously important and an important component of scientific life before World War II. But the publishers, again, they did many other things, and they charged their members some sort of membership fee to be a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, for example, or the American Medical Association. You pay a membership fee and you get your journal. After World War II, things started to change in the industry in that commercial publishers began to see this as a market for expansion. There were, you know, roughly 2,000 scientific journals in around 1960, maybe slightly fewer. Scientists, you know, have an almost insatiable appetite for publishing their work, right? It doesn't have to be a discovery by Albert Einstein. It doesn't have to be the theory of relativity. There are very much smaller discoveries that individual scientists will think are worthy of publication. With 2,000 journals worldwide, not every scientist is going to be able to publish in a journal. You know, many of these results will go unpublished. And there's an argument that that's actually not good for social utility, right? We want as much knowledge out there as possible. So commercial publishers saw a gap and a market need. Scientists are willing to provide this content for free. They want to do it. There aren't enough journals, so we're going to create some journals. And journals got created by commercial publishers, lots of them, so that now there are over 20,000 of these journals, and they cover a lot of very narrow subspecialties. So you asked about the financial interest. The financial interest of a commercial publisher is to sell subscriptions to their journals, to their magazines, just as though they were selling Time or Newsweek or Sports Illustrated or, you know, any other magazine. The difference is, whereas you can subscribe to Sports Illustrated for, I don't know, $100 a year, a subscription to one of these scientific journals in a specialized field is going to run you $10,000, $20,000, $25,000 a year, which is quite steep. And it's a pretty lucrative business, so the financial incentive for these publishers is pretty great. They get their content for free, the peer reviewers do their work for free, and they make a nice profit off of subscriptions.
And so let's pause at that number, because I think that's a number that would be shocking to many listeners and even people in other fields who do academic writing. $20,000 to $25,000 a subscription for works of authorship for which the journals don't have to pay. How is that? I mean, other than generally saying the market will bear it, how do the journals have, and I'll use this word, the audacity to charge such high amounts?
Right. Well, so journals argue, and with some justification, that they don't do nothing, right? They're not just a passive pass-through intermediary. They do add some value, and, you know, they organize this peer review process that we discussed. They do initial screening of the crackpot articles and the articles that are out of the field, and then they do formatting. They often gussy up the illustrations for the articles. They publish them, right? Many of them still print paper copies of journals that you get in your mailbox. They maintain an archive on their website. You can search it. They send out emails. You know, so they do something. They don't do zero. It's been argued that what they do does not justify that level of pricing, but that's an economic argument. They say it does. And what enables them, of course, to charge those rates is that the market will bear it, and they own the copyright in the articles, and so they have an absolute right to do with them what they wish.
We're chatting with Professor George Contreras of American University School of Law on Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. KZSU, for those of you who listen regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue listening to both the station and to Hearsay Culture. So in the midst, George, of this this scientific publishing scenario, where you have high subscription fees and you have prestige and power and financial benefit from publishing in the top journals, where does sharing fit into that model?
Right. The cost of journals starting in the 1970s and then through the 90s particularly, but even today, the cost of journals increased to such a level that a lot of smaller libraries, academic libraries, both in the developed world but particularly in the developing world, were not able to afford to subscribe to all of the journals that their faculty wanted. If you were doing research in hematology and there are three hematology journals, your library might have to pick just one and drop the other two subscriptions. And that made scientists upset. And so starting in the early 90s, and by the way, that phenomenon was called the cereals crisis. It's sort of a popularized term that's been applied to this escalation in price and then the subsequent dropping of subscriptions by academic libraries in a fairly widespread manner. And the result of that was a movement that began in the early to mid-90s called the open access movement, and some pretty prominent scientists and policymakers, Harold Varmus, a Nobel laureate who also was the head of the National Cancer Institute, the National Institutes of Health. He's back again for a second run at the head of the National Cancer Institute today. Mm-hmm. He and others have argued that scientific knowledge should not be confined to very expensive journals so that only people at rich institutions can afford to get the knowledge, because that prevents other scientists from doing their job, right? Scientists at other institutions who can't read the journals can't advance their own work. They don't know what the recent discoveries are, and that's bad for science and bad for society in many ways. So this open access movement spawned a lot of different theories about how we can improve this situation of limited access. And I can talk about some of the different models, but they resulted in a set of journals called gold open access journals that don't charge subscription fees but charge authors to publish in them. There are methods of self-archiving where scientists and anybody can just put up their own work on a number of different websites. And there's some governmental and institutional programs that are calling for broader open access as well.
And so that gets us into, I think, now to the heart of your article. So in the midst of all of this, right, copyright stands to both, in this case, right, benefit the publishers in the sense that they can control, once they publish the article, what happens to it, but also the authors retain some copyright, right, prior to actually signing the publication agreement. So talk to us in a little more detail about where copyright fits in this model, and then ultimately getting to the problem that you see with copyright in this field.
Right, so copyright, it's actually sort of counterintuitive why copyright is even an issue in this field, because as we all know from, you know, our law school education, there's no copyright in scientific facts, right? We look back at the Feist and Rural telephone case and so forth, and the AP and INS case, and there's no copyright in the basic scientific facts, the discoveries that are being made. But when a scientist writes an article, right, the words, the expression that he or she puts down on paper is copyrightable. And so the exploitation of that article, its reproduction, its distribution, its publication, is controlled by the person who controls the copyright. When the scientist writes the article, copyright generally remains with the scientist. Unlike in industry, universities typically don't ask for an assignment of all copyright by their employees, by their academic employees. So when the publication agreement comes across the scientist's desk and it gets signed, that affects an actual transfer of the copyright to the journal, which then gives the journal the exclusive right during the copyright term to exploit the article. And again, because they control that right exclusively, they can charge what the market will bear for it, and they can prevent others from distributing, republishing, and copying. And there are some exceptions now that have been introduced into this picture as a result of the open access movement and the work of certain institutions. But that's the basic copyright landscape.
And so with that model in mind, we can think about some of these issues. So in the article, right, you spend a good amount of time talking about this crisis, with a focus on how specialized journals have been involved. But particularly, you wrote, and again, I recognizing that this is a draft, but I can summarize it, I think. You point out that critics of this industry generally point out that some costs must be incurred in creating the works, but with regard not only to subscription rates, but also to the cost structure, that the scientific journals themselves are impeding or creating problems with this sharing model. So perhaps you could spend a little time explaining how scientists literally will share information in light of the incentives from both the authors and the publishers to get work out there in this format.
So scientists have a number of different incentives and goals, right? I mean, one, they want to publish in journals because that advances their careers, but they do want to share their information. They want it to be spread around as broadly as possible so that other scientists know what they've done. That gives them recognition in their field. It doesn't help if you make a discovery and nobody knows about it. You do want some recognition for it. And as I said, you also want the government to know that you are publicizing the work. So what scientists have an incentive to stick with the journal system to the extent that they can, but also to share their work. So one interesting phenomenon that's arisen that we're all very familiar with in the legal academic field is self-archiving. Right? This is a practice where scientists will take their article, which they have the copyright in, and post it on a website in its pre-published form. This is what I'm going to do with this article, in fact, in a week or so. I'll post it on SSRN, which is the Social Science Research Network. SSRN takes articles in law, economics, political science, and a number of other social science fields. And people will be able to read it. And they will, perhaps read it, perhaps send me comments. I will revise it and post revised versions. And then someday, God willing, I will get this article published in a journal. Mm-hmm. Unlike a scientist, however, law reviews are much more generous in what they allow you to do with their article. So if this were a scientific article, after I published it on SSRN, and I submitted it to the journal, there would be editing that took place at the journal in response to the comments from the peer reviewers. And then there would be a question as to whether and to what extent I could self-archive or post up on my university's website that article, and in what form I could do it. At one end of the spectrum, the journal, in its publishing agreement, could say, no, you know, we own the copyright in this article. You sold it to us, so you can no longer post it on a website. You can't do anything with it. That would be sort of the old traditional model. I'd say that has really been beaten down recently. Many journals will now allow the posting of what's called a preprint of the article. That is, your author's draft that you submitted to the article prior to its acceptance. The journal really at that point, you know, hasn't contributed anything to the article. So sometimes they will allow that to be published on an individual faculty webpage or a site like an SSRN or Archive, which is the site in the physical sciences and space sciences. Some journals will allow you to post what's called a postprint, which is your article after it's been accepted, after you've incorporated comments from the peer reviewers, but before it's put into final form, galley form for publication. So it doesn't include the journal editor's line edits or the artwork that they produce or formatting or other edits that the journal produces. So sharing can occur in that way also. Almost never will the journal allow, and there's a big exception to this, but typically the journal will almost never allow the reposting of the final published article. And the published article is important. People actually care about looking at the published article for a number of reasons. First, pagination and citation. The definitive citation to the article is the published article. Second, changes can be made at the last minute, and those can be important changes. Changes in data or in figures. I've had this come up myself in an article that I recently published in a scientific journal. One of the editors found a slightly inconsistent statement, which was there because just because of the lapse of time between when the article was written and when it was finally accepted for publication, they found something that needed to be updated. And that update only occurred in the final published form. Someone who was looking at that article on SSRN would have seen the old date and the old reference, which again wouldn't have been critical, but it's not what the final article actually said.
So when we're thinking about this problem, and as you write about in the article, there's a big issue here regarding the duration of copyright. And so the fact that the length or the term of the copyright is so long creates this latency issue, but also creates the barrier to the kind of sharing that we might want. So perhaps you could talk a little bit now about duration and also about your solution of a one-year copyright.
Right. So copyright in the U.S. lasts for the life of the author plus 70 years, which is a long time, right? That means that anyone who's going to live a reasonable period of time, that the copyright in their work is going to last for more than 100 years. And that time period has ratcheted up, over the years. Originally, copyright was 14 years with a 14-year renewal in the U.S. Now we're over a century. And that's viewed as long. And there are lots of arguments about that, and that's been litigated in the Supreme Court, and the term has been upheld. And a significant debate around both the constitutionality and the practicality of having such a long copyright term. Most of that debate centers around creativity and creating incentives through copyright for the production of creative works. Works of authorship, again, typically viewed as creative books, movies, songs, and so forth. And so, you know, again, I'm very aware of that set of arguments and very sympathetic, actually, to those who say, even in terms of creative works, we don't need a 100-year copyright. But that's slightly aside from this point. With respect to scientific works, you know, the actual expression of the theory and the findings is not all that relevant. Scientists are not known for their unique prose styles. Or the fluidity with which they express their results. What you care about when you read a scientific article is, can I understand it at some level, and do the results make sense? So there's not really much creativity involved in them. And as we've discussed previously, the incentives to create scientific works are not the same incentives that you have necessarily to create novels or screenplays or works of poetry or music. You're not earning a royalty as a scientist from the publication of your work. So the incentive structure is very different between academic scientific works and general works subject to copyright. So some scholars, Stephen Chevelle at Harvard most recently, and David, you also mentioned Boldrin and Levine and their book. Mm-hmm. These people have argued that copyright should not exist at all. Copyright should be abolished on scientific work. So the incentive function of copyright is not being served, and all that copyright is doing is enabling publishers who take the copyright to extract essentially a monopoly rent for a very long time for the exploitation of these works. I am sympathetic to those arguments as well. Stephen Chevelle's article, which came out in 2009 on this topic, has generated a lot of conversation in this area. That being said, you know, I'm not sure that I would go all the way to abolishing copyright in this area. Number one, it's difficult to draw a fence around what the area actually is. And in the paper, I try to tease out how one might do that. And it becomes difficult. Whether you are going to limit this just to academic scientific authors, well, why would you do that? Lots of very important articles are written by people from industry, Nobel Prize winners who work in industry and publish in these same journals. So line drawing is difficult. There are also difficulties around our treaty obligations and the abolition of copyright in a certain area could impact those, not to mention just the difficulty of getting such an amendment through Congress, which has proven very willing to simply increase the term of copyright rather than decrease it. So there are some practical issues as well. So the proposal that I make in the article, it's not exactly accurate to say that I propose a one-year copyright on scientific articles. I mean, those types of proposals have been made both in copyright and patent. A few years ago, there was a pretty popular proposal floating around to create a five-year or three-year patent on software, mini patent, mini copyright. Again, I'm not particularly sanguine about the political prospects of getting that type of legislation enacted sort of in this political environment. So my proposal is really one of private ordering, and that's where the other part of the title comes from. Mm-hmm. And I get to this by having made some observations of how the scientific publishing world has been acting over the last few years. I mentioned that there are policies that have been enacted by some granting agencies, most notably by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, also private funding sources like the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, the Wellcome Trust in the U.K., the MacArthur Foundation, all of which require that after a certain period of time, after an article is published, it should be released publicly on an open access basis. The NIH policy says that, look, any research funded by the NIH, and again, that's in excess of $30 billion of research a year in the U.S. alone, any article that comes from NIH-funded research must be deposited in this NIH public database a year after its initial publication. Some other areas where, you know, those types of shortened time periods have come about are private negotiations between some large universities and publishers, as well as some voluntary periods that some of the scholarly associations have come up with, where they will publish articles in their journal, send it to all of their members, but then after 6 months or a year, they'll release their articles publicly. And so it appears if you gather up all of these different scenarios in which stakeholders have gotten together and negotiated about the access to scientific articles, you find an emerging trend, which is that generally, within 6 to 12 months, publishers have conceded that articles can be released to the public without destroying their economic interest, right? Publishers can survive and can still sell subscriptions if the subscribers get access to the articles for a year before they're made openly accessible for free. And we've not seen any fallout, really, from an industry standpoint of these policies. Publishers are still doing just fine. They can still charge as much as they like for their journals. Publishers have not gone out of business as a result. And so my proposal is that this type of private ordering solution should be adopted as broadly as possible. And perhaps in a uniform manner, so that the publishing agreement that your average scientist signs with the publisher changes. And it doesn't assign the publisher the full copyright for infinity, but assigns the publisher a license, an exclusive license for 1 year to publish the article and to be the exclusive publisher and distributor of the article. But after that, to have a non-exclusive license, so that the publisher could continue to publish the article, of course, as long as it likes, but the author retains the copyright and could either self-publish or submit the article in an open access journal or any of a number of things that would at least get the information out to those who can't afford the primary journal subscription.
With the remaining five or so minutes that we have, George, I get to the unfair questions, the questions for which you don't have enough time to answer, and so I tailor them as much as possible. In terms of pushback on this proposal, I know that you are talking about this article and this proposal in a variety of settings. In terms of pushback, what's been the biggest objection, if you will, to this solution, and what's your response to it?
Well, they come from several quarters, right? And from the publishing industry and from those who value strong copyright, the publishing industry has continued to argue that, well, they can't meet their costs, and this sort of thing will harm the industry. And they continue to introduce legislation in Congress that would abolish the NIH open access policy that I just mentioned, mm-hmm. and so forth. And I'm not sure I find that particularly credible argument, just given the economics of the situation. Fine. From a more academic standpoint, you could ask whether this 6 to 12 month period is the right period. How do we know it's right? There's not an economic model that leads us to a 12 month period before open access is granted, right? This is sort of formed on the basis of empirical observations, but without much theory behind it. And it's difficult to formulate a model because we don't know the economics of the industry that well. We know some, but not all of them. You could also ask whether this theory and this approach is extensible to other markets. And that's one of the things that I find the most interesting about this project. I mean, I think it has value, I hope, in scientific publishing. But you might ask yourself, well, what about other copyright industries? There's another very important copyright industry in which there are intermediaries who don't contribute a whole heck of a lot to copyrighted works, but keep the copyright for a long time and make a lot of money, and that's the music industry, right? There's criticism that the record labels are simply intermediaries that don't do a heck of a lot and don't contribute a whole lot of value to their product, but they lock up the copyright and make a lot of money at the expense of many musicians and artists. And are there analogies that can be drawn here? There are similarities and there are differences between scientific publishing and music. And I think starting down a path where we look at private ordering approaches to try to alleviate some of the leverage that this very, very long copyright gives to intermediaries is something of potential use, something that I hope will be of use.
George, when we as we close our discussion, I'm curious to get your thoughts on what you think scientists themselves would say about this proposal. It seems like it would be a net gain for them, and there would be limited downside. But do you anticipate that this, you know, radical shakeup, at least from the standpoint of how the industry, as it were, has thought about their ability to share, would potentially cause any consternation on the academic side of the equation?
The scientists are going to be worried if they think that this is going to jeopardize their ability to have their articles accepted by journals, which is why it's important that this be sort of a unified effort on the part of institutions, right? If there's some large institutions, very prestigious institutions, who have managed to extract concessions already from publishers, but you're much more run-of-the-mill institution. It's not a big name. Scientists are, their number one priority is to get published. And anything that they would do that would rock the boat, for example, objecting to the publication agreement that could tick off an editor, I think they would view as jeopardizing their chances of getting published. And they'd probably be right about that. So I think that if this type of private ordering approach is going to work, there have to be some trailblazers, which there have been, but then there has to be a broad take-up of the proposal by the general community. And this sort of fear and inertia in the community are probably the greatest obstacles to its success.
Professor George Contreras, American University School of Law, author of the currently draft version, but will be available on SSRN next week, and I will post it. The article, Wait For It, Latency, Copyright, and the Private Ordering of Scientific Publishing. George, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I appreciate you being here. This is an issue which, again, as you mentioned, initially might sound narrow, but the implications of scientists' abilities to share information, and I know it's a topic you don't take up in your article, nor am I going to start discussion now, which could lead to greater innovation and thought in the field, is a critical one, and I thank you for joining us today to enlighten my listeners on this topic.
It's been a pleasure.
Let me mention a number of guests that are coming up this quarter on Hearsay Culture. I'm looking forward to chatting next week with Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School, the article Orwell's Armchair. Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law regarding her article Illuminating Innovation. Professor Daniel Margoxi of Hunter College, co-editor of the forthcoming volume of the British Journal for the History of Science on Secrecy. Professor Jennifer Holt of the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of the book Empires of Entertainment. Professor Julie Cohen of Georgetown Law, author of the book Configuring a Network Self. Professor Hamilton Bean of the University of Colorado, Denver, author of the book No More Secrets, Open Source Information and the Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence, I think a related topic to what we discussed with George today. And rounding out this quarter, Baron Zilka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of The Next Digital Decade. I have been exceptionally busy this academic year, as I've mentioned on the show before. I am up for tenure, which doesn't mean that I do anything differently. It just means that I'm particularly busy. And I have been focusing heavily on my own writing, which is focused heavily on both the substantive and the procedural problems associated with international intellectual property law agreements that are currently being negotiated, among them the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And on the domestic side, my concerns with regard to the Stop Online Privacy Act and Protect IP. That has kept me quite busy, along with teaching half of our first-year class at Elon University School of Law, as well as additional other administrative entities. And by the way, I'm also a husband and father of two wonderful little boys. So it's all good stuff. As my grandfather would have always said, we should all have these problems. Having said that, what it means is, for Hearsay Culture, that I am not as far along as I usually am in booking guests for the upcoming quarter, which will begin in April after a short hiatus at the end of March or beginning of April. So if you have any suggestions of guests you'd like to have on the show, people you think would be good guests for Hearsay Culture, I encourage you to email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, dave@hearsayculture.com. And I will be in the process of reaching out to a variety of individuals pretty much beginning in March to book them for the upcoming quarter. And I would welcome any suggestions you have, as well as any feedback or comments with regard to the show. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live on KZSU Stanford, noon Pacific time on Fridays. You can also get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous 150-plus shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. You can get the show by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, which you can find through the iTunes search engine. You can also get the show by going to the RSS feed on Stanford CIS's website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Regardless of how you listen to the show, I do welcome your feedback, and I thank you for listening. So I hope you've enjoyed today's discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.